It's the Frame Weekend. Today, we visit filmmaker Ava DuVernay in her sprawling creative complex.
Well, it's my favorite place in the world. It has people of color and women in its DNA as a part of its building. People who are usually uncentered are the epicenter of our work here.
Later, the documentary Jawline unpacks the crazy fangirl culture around young social media influencers.
You know, for a teenage girl, it's actually really hard because, you know, you're more mature than a lot of the boys in your school. So you're looking for some sort of intimacy.
We say goodbye to Celso Piña, the Mexican musician known as the accordion rebel. And we talk about black music in America, from minstrel shows to Motown and even yacht rock. It's the Frame Weekend from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. I'm John Horn. We'll be right back. This is the Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. On this show, we talk with creative people about how and why they do what they do and about how their art is shaped by the wider world. We'll start today with New York Times critic at large, Wesley Morris. He writes some of the most thoughtful, smart, and funny commentaries on culture anywhere. And this past week, he wrote a deep essay on music. It's titled, "For Centuries, Black Music Forged in Bondage has been the sound of complete artistic freedom. No wonder everybody is always stealing it." The essay was part of the Times Project 1619. It's focused on the narrative of black Americans, their contributions to this country, and how the nation's history has been shaped by slavery and racism. 1619 is the year that the first Africans were sold to colonists on U.S. soil.
Nicole Hannah Jones, this is her, this project is her brainchild. And what she wanted me to do was to try to find some way of telling a version of this story that puts a black contribution at its center. The most obvious and important thing to do in terms of the way that black music sort of migrated to the center of American culture is it starts in minstrelsy.
And yet you start your essay with yacht rock. Like a musicologist, you look at yacht rock and start taking apart the sounds and orchestrations of what you hear there. And what do you find? What is the link between minstrelsy and yacht rock?
The connection between minstrelsy and yacht rock is essentially that you have the remnants of black music showing up in what yacht rock as a musical designation would like you to think is just generic, happy, light, white music. But in my experience listening to it, what I was hearing song after song after song was something more soulful than just this sort of light, boat-oriented rock. You know, there's some artists like Michael McDonald who I, as a black American person, understand to be a practitioner of black music, a sincere practitioner of black music. And obviously, minstrelsy, for anyone who isn't really explicitly aware of how it worked, was white men dressing up as black men, painting their faces black with burnt cork, and performing in blackface. You know, the minstrel show, as it was developed, became an entertainment that was entirely predicated upon white men in blackface, regardless of what they did, whether they were giving speeches or singing songs or doing dances. And so a lot of these questions about how we think about and how we treat black people, especially culturally in terms of what we expect them to be able to do, singing and dancing are these things that just come naturally to black people. Those ideas come out of minstrelsy.
And that changes with the advent of radio. I want to play a track first. Let's listen to a little Nat King Cole.
The falling leaves drift by the window. The autumn leaves.
So what you write is that his voice is suitably white. And so he is acceptable on radio. But then television comes along and he's too black.
Yeah, basically. You know, he has a show that lasts for, I think, 18 months. And it gets canceled because the sponsors sort of drop out. And there are boycotts in the South. And they can't support Nat King Cole, who at that point was one of America's most popular entertainers. But I don't hear him sing, and I don't hear a white person. I hear a distinctly black person.
I'm going to move ahead now to Motown, where you start to get a very interesting blend of kind of traditional Western orchestration with church vocals. This is a Four Tops song.
I think we don't quite appreciate how important Motown was. You know, this is happening. Motown happens during the Civil Rights era, at the peak of the Civil Rights era. And it is not political music. It is not ostensibly political music, at least during the 1960s, it's not. And these are mostly love songs. Nonetheless, all of these different musics converge in Motown, and you have, you know, strings and horns and bells and tambourines and guitars and drums and bass. It's just like an onslaught of music that you've never heard before and sung in a way that, you know, nobody had ever sung with that kind of musical sophistication before. They were inventing a new way of singing and sounding and producing music. And it just, I mean, in terms of the proliferation of black imagery, you had these men in these suits, and these women in these gowns, and it just, it was such the antidote to what minstrelsy was doing in its project to humiliate, degrade, and dehumanize black people.
We're talking with Wesley Morris from the New York Times about his essay for the 1619 Project about black music. You write, when we're talking about black music, we're talking about horns, drums, keyboards, and guitars doing the unthinkable together. And it made me think about a song. I'm going to play a little bit from this song. So that is the average white band playing what I think, if you didn't know who they were, you might say that could have been, you know, Tower Power. It could have been some other mostly black band.
Ohio Players, yeah.
Yeah. What does that say about appropriation and who owns that music? And does it matter who's playing it?
No, it doesn't. I mean, well, this is the whole thrust of my thinking about this, right? Like, I don't think that the intent is really what matters. The important thing to note, and the sort of celebratory nature of the piece, is really that black culture had sort of migrated to the center of American culture by the time you get the average white band and, you know, Motown average white band on into the 80s, right? The way that blackness and black culture is sort of baked into American culture can't be extracted. It's just going to come down to each individual performer and whether each act is sincere in their use of black music. But there's also ways in which you could be using elements of black music and not even know. But the idea that I can hear blackness in music not necessarily designated as R&B or soul is so indicative of the way that black musical ideas and black musical traditions just wind up as part of the American tradition.
Right. And I think intention is one thing, and I think it's also important how that music is received. I'm going to play a song by a country artist who's from Atlanta, Georgia. So that's Lil Nas X, and his song has sparked this huge debate because a lot of people, especially those people working at Billboard, who say it's not country enough, which I guess means it's too black. How does that song kind of define where we are?
It isn't as though country music has never had any black people perform country music. The list is not terribly long, but it's important. You know, Charlie Pride, Ray Charles, Darius Rucker. And so I love this fight because I feel like it is proof of this thing that has already happened, and country music is trying to draw a line around itself to say, you know, keep out, please don't let this thing that has already happened and has been underway for 40, 50 years. We don't want that in this little realm we have going on here.
What has been the response to your essay that has really intrigued you the most?
Most people have sort of focused on, in my case, the idea that it's kind of a mess, right? Like trying to determine where everything comes from. It's more fun in some ways to just enjoy how good the music is. And there are white people involved at various stages, you know, positively involved in various stages of the production of black music, and black people involved in various stages of production of music that we wouldn't consider black. I do think that there is, and some of the response I've been getting is just like a kind of enthusiasm for the idea that black people have allowed a kind of optimism to remain in popular culture, and that comes out of a very terrible circumstance.
Wesley Morris is a critic at large of the New York Times. Wesley, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. Thanks a lot.
You cry and cry and try.
Okay, let's... Where are we headed, John?
We're headed to... I don't even know what this neighborhood is. It's like Angelino Heights.
The other day, Frame producer Robert Garova and KPCC's photojournalist Shava Sanchez and I hopped in my car, and we drove towards downtown L.A.
But we're going to go see Ava DuVernay, who's got apparently a whole compound down there. So let's hit the road.
I first met her years ago when she was working as a film publicist. Now, she's a writer, she's a director, a producer, and an activist. She made the Oscar-nominated movie Selma, also the big Disney movie A Wrinkle in Time. In television, she created the show Queen Sugar and the Netflix limited series When They See Us, and that show is now in the running for 16 Emmys.
Let's see, right place. Hi, we're here to see Ava.
Ava is just as committed to helping other people get their work out to the public as she is her own. In 2010, she started her company, Array. It acquires and distributes films by people of color and women. And she does all of this out of her sprawling creative complex.
Are we recording? Are we on?
We are.
It started?
It has started.
Okay.
It's going. Tell us about this space. I mean, we're sitting in your theater right now. This whole campus feels amazing. So on any given day, what's going on around here?
Well, it's my favorite place in the world. I built the place that I couldn't find. You know, a place here in L.A. that's really has people of color and women in its DNA as a part of its building, not as an inclusion program, not as a diversity initiative, but in every space and in every program and in everything that we do here, every project, people who are usually uncentered are the epicenter of our work here. And so to have this space, which we just, this actual theater space within the campus, which we just opened about 2 months ago, is like a miracle for, you know, a black girl from Compton who loves movies to now own her own, you know, 50-seat stadium-style theater, DCP compliant with Dolby. I mean, come on. It's fantastic. So, and here we show the work of people of color and women, and we analyze all kinds of films and do film literacy and distribute our own work.
So if you are showing a movie in here, in your theater, is that something where you might actually bring people in?
We're actually, gosh, you're the first person I'm talking to about it, but we're actually unveiling and announcing our fall program. So our plan is every fall have a 6 to 7 week program of very specific public programming open to the public. And so we've been curating this. The director of programming, Mercedes Cooper, and I have been working on this for about 6 months. There's some very exciting, a few premieres. Some restored classics that I haven't played in LA before, and just a real curatorial eye that is focused on prioritizing work of people of color and women of all kinds. And yeah, there'll be tickets open to the public pretty soon. In addition to that, we distribute films, and so those films will have full runs here in this theater.
It's easy to say that you are in Hollywood. I mean that almost kind of metaphorically, but it's true that you are in Los Angeles, and those are two different. Very different places, Hollywood and LA. Mm-hmm. What does Los Angeles, what does the city mean to you, and how do you hope it's represented in stories, and how does it inform you as a storyteller?
So nice to be asked a question like that. I rarely ask questions that aren't about being black or being a woman. I guess because my work is about being black and being a woman, but also I'm a filmmaker, so I like to talk about craft and ideas, so thank you for that. I love LA so much. I was born and raised here. This last one, When They See Us, was hard to make because I had to be away from here. And I'm really dying to make something that is based in LA. I have a TV show now that's based here that we're just getting started on. But what LA means to me is it is a true educational experience to me, because there's a little bit of everyone here and they have space. That's the difference between LA and New York. You can be who you are and have the space to be that. This is a sprawl. It's spread out. And so whether you're in spaces where it's a large Persian community, you know, I love driving through behind Melrose because I always see beautiful families, Orthodox Jewish families walking together. And then I go a little bit further and I'm in Koreatown. And then, and it's not just a block, like it's a full little city, you know what I mean? People can really put their roots down here and it grows into these beautiful kind of flowers of an array of people. That's what I love about it. And I grew up in Compton, which was not just a black space. Compton, Linwood, Long Beach, Southgate. It was black and brown. It's Filipino, Guatemalan, Mexican, black, American, African. It was all kinds of people there. And that's the kind of city this is. It starts to get
homogenous.
Homogenous when you get into quote unquote Hollywood, but that's not really LA. I hate it when people come here and they go to Beverly Hills and they're like, ah, it's kind of fake. I'm like, dude, you didn't go anywhere. You went from LAX to like the Beverly Hilton. You didn't experience it.
We're talking with Ava DuVernay at her offices near downtown LA, in historic Filipino town.
That's right.
Your series is called When They See Us. And there's so much about that title. It could describe this series. It could describe what drives you. It could describe the void that a lot of people like you are trying to fill. What does the title mean to you? Why did you apply it? And what do you think it means?
Gosh, I liked all those meanings. Thank you. I'm going to use that. If you hear me say that somewhere else, now that I got it from John Horn. For me, it was really about a title that had some meat on the bone, was about more than just Central Park 5. That was the working title for a long time. I felt that it was, you know, I became allergic to it. It had no meaning. It had no emotion to it. It felt really just like a moniker that had been given to these men by a lazy press corps at the time, by, you know, political entities and the police. They were grouped together. It dehumanized them. So as I knew it, that wasn't the title. And I was looking for something that really spoke to what I'm trying to do, which is talk about, and inherent in the title is a them and an us, right? And who is the they and who is the us? And that's really the way that so many people of color feel, particularly black people, particularly black men, that no one is walking in their shoes in this country. No one quite understands, the scourge of being a black man in any space in this country, a black woman in these spaces. So it is really kind of calling attention to the divide. And then, you know, the behavior that's put on the divide, a shaping that's always done, a review, an analysis of us based on how we look and not on who we are. And so all of that, a lot of what I've studied about Dr. King is also embedded in that title, that, you know, when I look at you walking down the street, John Horn is a very attractive man. He's a debonair kind of guy. I see you and assume, oh, upstanding gentleman and law-abiding citizen. You look like that type. You could be anything, but the way you look has come to mean safe and okay, right? And the way that I look and my friends and some of my friends that I was with last night would mean just the opposite for someone if you're looking up in the dictionary. So this whole idea of optics and who we really are and humanity, all of that's embedded in the title. And, you know, you got to get to the end of it to maybe understand it. That's why John Horn knows what the title means, because he watched it.
All the way to the end.
To the end.
Ava, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Ava DuVernay's limited series, When They See Us, is on Netflix. Coming up, like me, you might not have heard of TikTok, but the meme-generating music sharing app might very well have determined the two big songs of the summer. It's the Frame Weekend. Thanks for joining us. I'm John Horn. There's a whole lot going on in the internet and on different social media apps that I rarely see. A lot of what I've been missing is focused on young social media influencers. So this new documentary called Jawline really opened my eyes. It's about a streaming app called You Now.
Hey, should I keep the chin hair? Yes. Or should I keep the chin hair? No. You can't like really see it though, to be honest. Yo, thank you for the applause, Emily. Thank you so much. Erica, how you doing? Shave it.
The film is about the app's pretty boy influencers, their fangirls, and the emerging culture of live streaming celebrity. Here's Liza Mandeloup on the genesis of her documentary.
It kind of started with me thinking I wanted to tell a story about teenagers in love and what it looks like today. What does that feeling look like for a teenager when technology is like an extension of yourself? So I just started thinking about those themes and doing some research, and I found these things called meet and greets, which are in the film, where these teenage girls were paying money to spend time with the boy that they had been following online. Hug them, take a photo with them, kiss them, and the emotions that were at that show were just insane to me. People freaking out, going crazy, crying, feeling like they had met the love of their life, but it was thousands of girls per one boy.
When I met him, I was like, oh my gosh, I love you. And he was like, oh, I love you too. And I was like, oh, yay.
It's kind of like, I think for older people, it's like young girls when the Beatles came to the country.
Yeah.
And yet these kids don't do anything. It's not like they're singing. I mean, they're like just there. Some of them shoot silly string at people. Some of them kind of lip sync or dance around, but they don't have any real performance, do
yeah.
they?
Well, I mean, the concept is the live streaming world is about live with me, live my life with me, and I will be affectionate to you on social media. I'll be positive towards you. I'll tell you, you look great. I'll ask you how your day was, but I'm just a regular person, which is really bizarre to me. Like, it's like their commodity is just sort of this validation to these girls. The ridiculous part of the film is what that in-person experience is. Like, what are you paying for? You're basically paying just to see the person you've been following on a screen in person for the first time.
One of the people you spend a lot of time with is a kid named Austin Tester. He's a 16-year-old who is in a small town in Tennessee named Kingsport. And he is a very interesting and complicated kid.
Fame to me is really important. When you become famous, you have a lot of people that look up to you.
He is a very positive kid, and he comes from a very troubled family, abusive father, single mom, they're not well off. But his message is all about inspiring other people to follow their dreams.
My dream is not to get famous, and then that's just it. My goal is to get famous, the money comes, and then I start helping the world.
I think he really has this hope that he can somehow use what he's doing online to create a new life for himself and somehow get out of this small town. Is that what you started to sense from being with him?
Austin's a dreamer, and I think that I'm always attracted to characters like that. He came from a situation where not many people in his town are able to have these big life dreams. Like, they don't see that as an option. Nobody tells them that's an option. And somehow Austin, against all odds, got that in his head that I want to get out of this place. I want to make a difference. But he didn't really have the support to do that when he decided he wanted to do that. And what gave him that support? The internet. And so Austin kind of represents this modern teen to me where you're no longer stuck in your circumstances. You can seek this other community online. And so what he did have was Wi-Fi. It wasn't even very good Wi-Fi, but he had Wi-Fi, you know?
We're talking with Liza Mandeloup. She's the director of a new documentary called Jawline. I think it's very easy to look at the girls who are so obsessed with a lot of these young boys and say it's kind of vacuous idolatry. But then the more time we spend with these girls, I think the more we start to understand what is in it for them. That often they are girls who are somehow marginalized. They might be unpopular. They might be gay or lesbian, and they're not recognized positively for who they are. Did you start to detect certain kinds of people, certain kinds of girls, even if they're all radically different.
Absolutely, yeah.
And what would you say their common attributes are?
I think that a lot of these girls were escaping something, and they were all looking for a way out of whatever their situation was, whether it was family problems, whether they were abandoned by the men in their life, whether they were being bullied at school, or they had, you know, learning disabilities, or a lot of girls talked about cutting themselves. Like, they just had a lot of struggle, and what they needed was to feel good about themselves. And, you know, for a teenage girl, it's actually really hard because you don't really connect with your parents very much at that age. And if people at school are being mean to you, and, you know, you're more mature than a lot of the boys in your school, so you're looking for some sort of intimacy.
Another element that you spend time with, and this is where I think the film for me and a lot of people is probably the most disturbing, are the managers, the people who are trying to promote these social media broadcasters and monetize them. There's a person you meet named Michael Wiest.
The nature of this social media business is making as much money as quick as you can, because everything has a expiration date and a time limit.
It's 20K now, so you have to do something.
Dude. Screw you. Like,
do a handstand. Let's test that out.
My goal is to capture the ones that I think are better than the rest, take them, rebrand them, monopolize that, so that everyone who's not part of that vision is taken out of the industry, so that it keeps quality control up and more money in my pocket.
I keep thinking of him as like a young Steve Jobs. He's just like an opportunist. It's a weird world to be managing young teenage boys who are putting out content for these girls. And I think it takes someone who is young and also part of that generation to really understand even what it is. So he kind of, you know, was able to create this world where they all lived in a mansion together and they created content all the time. And they looked at him like he was their manager, but he was also their friend and their equal. And it was just a really interesting dynamic to me. And the whole film kind of has this, it's an ecosystem that's like teenagers feeding off other teenagers.
You never explain the title of your film.
Oh, yeah.
What does it mean to you? What does Jawline mean?
So Jawline is... represents a lot of what the entry point into this world is for these boys. They kind of think, okay, I want to become something on social media, on this live broadcasting app. What do I have to do to be someone that girls like? And the first thing is this sort of Instagrammable chiseled jawline. And then when we told a lot of the boys that we were naming it Jawline, they were like, oh yeah, we get it. And all the girls in that world got it too. And it just represents the market to me, really, is that. It's like that's one of the only qualifiers to get in.
Liza Mandeloup is the director of the documentary Jawline. Liza, thanks so much for coming in and talking about your movie.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Jawline is in select theaters and on Hulu now. This is The Frame Weekend, and I'm John Horn. Now, another corner of the internet. This is about a social media platform that's had an oversized influence on this summer's top songs. It's called TikTok, and even if you've never heard of it, you've probably seen its signature videos on Instagram or Twitter. Millions of teens and young adults are on TikTok, and recently writer Brittany Spanos of Rolling Stone spent a week exploring the app. And she talks about how TikTok is really designed to make its videos go viral.
They're usually edited in a really fast pace. And the basis of the videos for most of them is that you tend to add a song from a well of songs that are available. They can lip sync to it. They can do various challenges to that audio.
And I would say that the variety of production is profound. There's an amazing video with a goldfish on a counter surrounded by lots of edible goldfish. I think the user said she spent 8 hours making that video. It's to an Adele song. And then there are a lot of things of people just kind of goofing off. So is that typical as well, that you get people who really spend a lot of time producing these videos and other people who just record themselves in a bathroom?
First off, that goldfish video is my favorite TikTok that I've seen. But yeah, I mean, the variety is pretty overwhelming. I think that what's interesting in contrast to Vine, which the users were doing a lot of the same challenges typically, but TikTok is all over the place. I mean, there are people who use it to kind of monologue. There are people who do dance challenges. There are people who are singing on there, people who are doing these really orchestrated videos and scenes that they're making. There's a variety in ages of the users. It's really fascinating how many different genres and styles of videos have come about in really a year.
The other thing that's interesting about the goldfish video is the Adele song, Someone Like You. It's a live version. So it does feel like people are looking at different ways of presenting music. And that gets us to a different conversation, which is about the songs that were really the chart toppers of the summer. One was Lil Nas X's Old Town Road. And the other one is Billie Eilish's Bad Guy, which is now the number one hit. So how much of those songs' success can be attributed to TikTok?
Yeah, I think it's sort of an interesting double-edged sword for it, because both those songs are as responsible for TikTok being put on the map more so, as well as those videos helping those songs grow, which is really fascinating to look at. But I mean, in terms of TikTok itself, because when it first became a big app, it was coming from these Gen Z, really young, creative lip syncers who were making just like really funny, quick viral videos that were starting to spread beyond TikTok, which is another point to make, is that TikTok makes it super easy to share on other social media platforms. You can share those videos directly from the app to your Instagram story, to Twitter, to literally anything you want to upload it to. But Old Town Road by Lil Nas X was one of the earliest songs to really blow up on that app and became a meme challenge. I got the horses in the bag. I mean, meme challenges beyond TikTok have been such an important way for songs to become famous. For Old Town Road to be part of a newfound love for yeehaw culture and country culture and turned into a kind of like fashion dance challenge hybrid that it became, I mean, that in itself, because it was spreading so quickly beyond TikTok, really helped both the song and the app blow up. And same with Bad Guy. Both those songs are positioned at a really fascinating time in their own growth, with how the app was even reaching more and more people.
Are there certain songs that work well on TikTok and that maybe lend themselves to challenges where people are trying to outdo one another in terms of how they've incorporated a clip from a song into some sort of short video?
The pace of a song like Bad Guy really helps the very choppy editing of a lot of TikTok videos and kind of matches that very well, and is really quick and it's really fresh and it's recognizable. So it's really about just sort of lobbing onto a very specific sound and pace of a song, as well as very literal lyrics being translated. For example, Boys by Lizzo. I like big boys, itty bitty boys, Mississippi boys, inner city boys. I like the pretty boys with the bow tie. Get your nails did, let it blow dry. I like a big beard, I like a clean face. People are taking all the list of boys that she mentions and cut between different dogs or like different stuffed animals or different people. And it's really fascinating how that in particular has been what stuck.
I'm wondering, are music labels starting to embrace TikTok? How would you describe the relationship between the artists and the labels and these videos?
I mean, a lot of labels have worked with TikTok, with TikTok users in particular. We're seeing a lot of TikTok influencers, if you will. And there have been cases where A&R people, managers, will pay TikTok users to play their song. I mean, that was a big part of Old Town Road, was that a user had been paid money to make a video with Old Town Road very early on. And then from that, it just spread. It's not super new for them to kind of glom onto a lot of these challenges. Labels were trying to create these not very organic challenges around songs. So, I mean, with TikTok, it's much easier to make it seem like an organic thing and seem like a very natural sort of way that people are finding this music.
Brittany Spanos is a staff writer at Rolling Stone. She's the author of the article, I Spent a Week on TikTok and All I Got Was a New Phone Addiction. Brittany, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on The Frame Weekend, filmmaker Issa Lopez couldn't get her haunted fairy tale, Tigers Are Not Afraid, into any big festivals, but she still managed to get the attention of Stephen King and Guillermo del Toro.
I can't avoid, even in the darkest situations, going into a little bit of humor. Because it is, you know, my nature, my personal nature, but it's also deeply ingrained into being what it is being Mexican. The darkest experiences are tinted by a magical view and by humor.
That's next on The Frame Weekend. Welcome back to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. The other day, I met Isa Lopez. She's a Mexican filmmaker, and her new movie is so original and well-made and really topical that I was shocked to hear that it didn't get into any of the big film festivals. And that's probably because it's so hard to define. The movie is called Tigers Are Not Afraid, and it has a little bit of everything. Horror, magical realism, drama, violence, even humor. It's a dark fairy tale about a band of children whose parents have been killed in drug-related violence in Mexico.
I don't believe in genres anymore. I think that the most interesting movies are the ones that use elements of one genre or the other to tell the story that they are trying to convey. And that is a nightmare for distributors because it's very hard to sell chocolate that is also sardines, but also bacon, you know? And I get it. I understand. But I feel that in this time of absolute saturation of content, we are so used to swap, you know, in a streaming between comedy and horror and genres, and it feels good. And we started sending the movie to all the big festivals in this continent, and it was rejected one after the other. And it was heartbreaking, and I was very close to giving up. And then reconsidered because it is a genre movie. It is a ghost story. It is a fantasy. And I went for the fantastic and genre circuit of festivals, and they loved it.
Yeah, so once you start appealing to kind of sci-fi genre crowds, they get it, even though it is really a movie that's grounded in reality. And I want to ask you about that reality, about these orphans who could exist pretty much anywhere around the world. These are children who've been orphaned by the drug wars. It feels like it starts almost as a nonfiction film.
Completely. The absolute intention of the movie was that it felt like a documentary, like a war documentary, because it is a war. And in the midst of this extreme reality feeling, the elements of fantasy and horror and the supernatural would be completely integrated and so would feel a lot more real than they usually feel in genre movies. And then to tap into magical realism and ghost stories.
The title of this film in English is Tigers Are Not Afraid, and you could say that it really applies to this gang of orphan children. The Spanish title is Vuelven, which means they come back. How would you describe that translation? Because they're very different titles from Spanish to English.
Distribution. The title should always have been Tigers Are Not Afraid. And the movie should have been named Los Tigres No Tienen Miedo in Spanish. But it is a tricky movie to distribute because it is a horror, it is a fantasy, but it is also this political expose and this drama. So the distributors were wary of going into the drama side of it and the reality side of it and wanted to stick to the horror elements. And they felt that Tigers Are Not Afraid was not scary enough. And I shyly suggested, well, when they return, which could be assumed to be about the ghosts. And they went with it.
We're talking with Isa Lopez, the writer and director of the film Tigers Are Not Afraid. There are different elements to the story, but I want to focus on one thing initially, and that is children who lose their parents at a young age.
Mom, ¿dónde estás? Tengo hambre. Háblame, porfa.
Why was that story important to you personally? And how much of this film do you think is about grief?
Well, I did lose my mother when I was 8 years old.
How old was she?
My mother was 46. And it was, of course, it was not in the horrendous situation that the characters in the movie go through. That said, the feeling of getting home and not finding your mother there and never having a chance to say goodbye. And then the feeling that her ghost is walking behind you is very personal.
Mama?
Weirdly enough, I didn't see it when I wrote the script. I thought it was not about me. Not until very late in treatments, a dear friend of mine came and said, you do know this is your own story. And I didn't. But it's funny how we treat our own trauma in art. And it was a great opportunity to talk about personal pain, but also about the pain that my country is going through, which is also personal, you know? And I think making peace with saying goodbye from your death, which is what Mexico in the end is about. We've always rejoiced in the concept that our death walk with us.
This is a film that involves some magical realism. It involves some violence. It involves some danger. It involves some grief. But these kids are also kind of funny. So I want to play a scene early in the film. One of the children is snatched, and the two of the boys are talking with the lead character, Estrella, about what they think happens when children are kidnapped.
Los agarran, se los llevan al chino. El chino los hace trocitos, venden sus partes.
Son narcos satánicos, tienen pacto con el diablo, y hacen hasta misas rojas.
Son negras.
The kids say that Chino, who is the narco boss in the film, chops up kids and sells their parts, and that he and his gang are satanic narcos, and they've made this deal with the devil. But because they're kids, they start squabbling over the correct words. So how did you manage humor, and how does this movie play to audiences depending on their sense of humor? Do some people laugh and some people don't think it's that funny?
Completely. First of all, I can't avoid, even in the darkest situations, going into a little bit of humor. Because it is, you know, my nature, my personal nature, but it's also deeply ingrained into being in what it is being Mexican. The darkest experiences are tinted by a magical view and by humor. And that happens in societies that know intimately conflict. And it's funny because the emotional moments in the movie, across the world, people connect. But the few comedic moments, and there are comedic moments, people laugh out loud very, very loudly in places like Belfast in Ireland.
Because of the Troubles, you think?
Yes, I think because there is a deeply understanding that in the middle of tragedy, you laugh. And in places like Amsterdam, not so much. They love the movie, but nobody laughed in those little moments. And when I asked them about it, what they said is, you know, they understand the concept of comedy, but laughing felt wrong because they're not used to this violence in the open. You know, so it depends on the culture.
Isa Lopez is the writer and director of the film Tigers Are Not Afraid, or Vuelven in Spanish. Isa, thanks so much for coming in.
So happy. Thank you, John.
Tigers Are Not Afraid is in theaters in L.A. and New York now. It will be available soon on the streaming platform Shudder. This is The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. We're going to stay in Latin America for the next story, but shift gears from movies to music. Colombian artists have made a big impact on the international pop music scene in recent years. Think of Carlos Vives, Shakira, Juanes, and J Balvin. The Frame contributor Beto Arcos traveled down to Colombia's capital, Bogota, and that's where he talked with some of the scene's movers and shakers to try to find out what's in the water down there.
At the Artico Recording Studios in Bogotá, producer and composer David Trujillo, a.k.a. Garcia, talks about his forthcoming pop album, anchored on Colombian traditional music. He'll record up to 35 songs, and then he'll choose a third of them for the album. The first song he's recorded is based on a rhythm called Bambuco. He Trujillo says today's Colombian music global explosion has a precedent in previous decades.
Yo creo que eso viene de hace décadas. O sea, realmente es algo que...
For many years, we had Colombian artists that have been at the forefront, who clearly understood that our music could be mixed in other styles and made in a more universal way.
The Colombian artist who helped pave the way is Carlos Vives. In 1995, after the global success of the album titled Clásicos de la Provincia, Vives released La Tierra del Olvido. This album marked the birth of what was called a new Colombian music, fusing traditional sounds with pop rhythms. Chucky Garcia is the programmer of Bogotá's biggest music festival, Rock al Parque.
Pero Carlos Vives es quien le da un salto comercial.
Carlos Vives is the one that takes the commercial leap with the backing of major Colombian label Sonolux. And that's how, at that specific time, in some way, Vives becomes the father of new Colombian music.
Garcia says the international explosion of the new Colombian music can be explained by looking at several factors. The hip-hop band Choke Keep Down is a good example of a group who started underground and is now an international success. They migrated from the Pacific coast of Colombia to Bogotá and established their musical project.
When I met them, the band was selling their demo. They played in bars and wherever they could play. So the Colombian artist who's succeeding today has already experienced an underground journey. When people see them today, it's already packaged, but it's the result of all that work they did for years.
Colombia is very particular in the sense that it has a lot of talent, and it sounds like a mouthful because I'm Colombian.
If anyone knows the Colombian music market and its success worldwide, it's Diana Rodriguez, founder and chief executive of Criteria Entertainment, a management agency. I spoke with Rodriguez at her office in Glendale. Rodriguez currently manages the Colombian rock band Diamante Eléctrico. She's been working in the music industry for almost 30 years and has seen the ups and downs of Colombian pop music.
We don't yet have that market where the audience is used to discovering artists. You know, our artists get discovered outside and then come back, you know, and that's the truth. So it's a market that's still growing and learning to discover its own artists, but it's a market that has been delivering nonstop hits for international from a while back.
Until July, Colombia's pop rocker Juanes had never performed at the country's biggest festival, Rock al Parque. Festival programmer Chucky Garcia says at first he was criticized for booking Juanes, a mainstream pop act, at an alternative rock festival. But after the concert, public opinion changed.
He's
an artist whose significant international experience has a lot of things to offer. And he's a model and a reference. And people who did not want him to be in the festival later admitted, "I don't like Juanes, but that's how you do a show in a rock festival."
Even if J Balvin is pop worldwide, his Colombian sound is very noticeable. Same for Messia Periné, same for Bomba Estéreo. There's always this footprint, you know, that they leave in the sound that is very unique to them.
Criteria's Diana Rodriguez says there's a particular quality about Colombian music that makes global the new local.
I think it's the identity. We've never really lost the Colombian identity as much pop as we go. But I think, you know, the roots are there. And we've, you know, our new talent has managed to kind of intertwine with other sounds without losing its identity. You know, so we've been able to grow and travel a lot and become part of that global movement, but without losing our local sound.
Back at the Artico studio in Bogotá, producer David Trujillo says a country like Colombia, with such a rich musical culture, will continue to have a big part in the global pop sound. He also has a prediction.
Music is so homogenous today. Everything sounds the same. You can't tell if it's Puerto Rican, Colombian, or Argentine. Everybody sings the same. There will be a need and a demand for new rhythms and new ways to mix music. We're starting to see it in other countries. If you listen to Rosalia, it's the result of mixing pop with flamenco.
Trujillo says the future Colombian pop music will be shaped by artists and producers who combine traditional rhythms and modern sounds with innovative mixing techniques. And maybe that will be the next wave of Latin pop music. For The Frame, I'm Beto Arcos.
And just to tag onto Beto's story, one of the song styles that originated in Colombia is the cumbia. Decades ago, it became hugely popular in Mexico, so much so that it's commonly believed that that's where the music started. One of the main progenitors of the cumbia was the Mexican singer and accordionist Celso Piña. He was a pioneer of the form and mixed it with other styles and collaborated with artists such as Lila Downs and Café Tacuba. Celso Piña died this week at the age of 66 after suffering a heart attack. This is one passing that doesn't call for somber music. And that will do it for this edition of The Frame Weekend. The show is edited by Darby Maloney and produced by Herb, Jonathan Shiflett, Robert Garova, and Julia Paskin. Valentino Rivera is our engineer. Andrea Gutierrez is our news clerk. Our intern is Paul Ratliff. Our opening theme music is by Taylor McFerrin. And our senior producer is Oscar Garza. I'm John Horn from the Moan Broadcast Center here at KPCC. Thanks for listening. Have a safe and happy weekend. We'll be back on Monday with the daily version of The Frame.